It's Wednesday, March 29th, 2006. This is Ellen Norrie. I'm interviewing Professor David Steinberg for the SIUE 50th Anniversary History.
30, right?
Yes. Yeah, so. Mm-hmm. So go ahead, and I'd like to know your reasons for coming to SIUE and why you stayed after you became a notable administrator.
I came in 1972. I'd been at Washington U for 5 years in the School of Engineering faculty. And basically, the School of Engineering at Washington U was primarily interested in grantsmanship and research and didn't really care about teaching. I had won 2 teaching awards and was writing textbooks. I was publishing some papers, but I was focusing on textbooks, and they really didn't care about that. And there was an opening in the math department here, and so I applied for it. And, actually, Earl Lazarson was the acting chair of the math department. It was his very first administrative duty that year, and so he's the one who hired me. And I stayed because I the mission was still to focus on excellence in teaching, and that was really something that was valued here. It wasn't just lip service. But they did allow, they did encourage and allow research to go on, and created the conditions under which it could. So I thought it was really a good match and a good mix of the university mission and my goals.
Yes.
In terms of staying, I mean, I liked it here. I think we know that many faculty who came here thinking it'd be 1 or 2 years, or 3 years, or 4 years,
ended
up staying
many.
For 30 and 40, and so
right,
I wasn't unusual in that regard.
No. Did you know John Rendleman at all?
Well, he was a president when I came. And he liked to meet with individual department faculty. So he would have meetings in a classroom with just each department separately. So I did have some interaction with him, but just on that level, I didn't really know him personally. He was probably really good for the university at that point because he was well connected at the state level and was politically astute.
Yes.
And also again allowed the academic mission to flourish. He didn't really try to mix into that.
That's right.
8 years later, Lazarson went from being acting chair to president.
Yes. Well, he actually went from acting chair to chair to provost.
To dean
to provost.
Yes.
I forgot dean.
But dean was like 2 years. I mean, each one was like 2 years.
Yeah, 2 years. Yes. So he
was an elevator instead of an escalator.
Well, did you, now when Earl Lazarson was president, you were chair of math, right?
No, I was never chair of math.
Oh, you're never chair of math?
No. I managed to avoid that.
You became...
I was willing to do it, but I was never selected to be the chair, so I never did that. Probably, I guess the one thing I didn't do, I was president of the local AUP chapter in the faculty senate. And the first director of assessment.
Yes.
And associate dean, but never department chair.
Yes. You were director of assessment for just 1 year.
Yeah, a year and a half.
Year and a half.
Yeah, I was appointed. I was still president of the faculty senate when I was appointed. For my last half of my term as senate president, I was also director of assessment.
So that was 91?
90, I think.
90? Okay.
Yeah. The actually was. Yeah. The January 1990 through June of 91, I was director of assessment, and then I was appointed acting dean of sciences. So I had to step aside as director of assessment. I didn't know how long that was going to last. So initially, I didn't leave the post, and so Louisa Bowen was appointed acting director of assessment.
Yes.
For my 1.5 years.
While you were acting dean of science.
Yeah, I ended up being acting dean for 4 years until they created CAS.
You were acting dean for 4 years?
Yes.
I guess I always thought you were dean. I never, I know I've looked at my notes and I had that in there, but I...
We did a, Don Meyer retired in 1990. And we had done a search, but it failed. Actually, I guess by the time he retired, they didn't do the search that first year. So Shankar Nair was appointed acting dean for the year 90 to 91. And then we did a search for a permanent dean, and it failed. At that point, Earl was considering creating the college. So they didn't reinitiate the search. And Shankar Nair went on leave, on sabbatical. So he only served as acting dean 1 year, and then they appointed me acting dean. He went off to India to do some research. So, you know, it was just from year to year. And, but after, I guess, one year or so of that, it was clear they were not going to do a search.
Yeah,
it was
gonna, okay.
Going to just kind of do a holding pattern until they created the college.
Yeah. Oh, because people always refer to you as the dean, not the acting dean.
Yeah, well.
And they have very good, positive things to say.
I was never actually chosen by the faculty. I was imposed from above.
Well, that was kind of the way Earl Lazarson did things, wasn't it?
Well, it was Warner, actually.
Oh, I mean, it was Warner?
Because he was the provost.
That's right. He was provost after July 86, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess he consulted. You know, I actually had been in that search, but wasn't selected.
I think he did.
I was not one of the people selected by the search committee. So, but he decided he did it anyway.
Yeah, why not? Later, that happened to him when he became acting president.
Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes that's for the best.
The tragedy was that Don Meyer, you know, had stepped down as dean. He was planning to remain on the faculty for about 3 or 4 more years and then retire. But he died 2 months after stepping down as dean.
Yes. He died of some sort of tropical thing that he had gotten.
The day stepped out as dean, June 30th, he flew down to, I think it was Venezuela, he was doing research. He had a research arrangement set up, and the very first day in the lab, he had some kind of stroke, and his colleague down there noticed that he, you know, wasn't responsive, and they put him in the hospital and shipped him back here fairly quickly, I guess, and he was in the hospital here for a couple of months. He was actually improving. He had this bizarre cough they couldn't figure out, but he was improving, and they were actually going to discharge him from the hospital when he suddenly died. I mean, it might have been a clot or something. I can't remember exactly, but they were actually going to discharge him from the hospital when he died.
He must have been a very lovely person.
He was, yes, he was.
Yeah, people seem to remember him and the arboretum.
So we named the arboretum after him, yeah.
Right.
Because that was one of his pet projects.
So you did, you became dean of the, or acting dean of the School of Sciences at a point where the university was really changing the calendar and moving toward college.
That's right, the calendar changed that too. Those were, I guess, two of Earl's big initiatives were the calendar change and the semester conversion and the creation of the College of Arts and Sciences. But prior to that, I guess his biggest contribution probably was his wizardry at budget and finance.
Yes.
Because we were going through some massive retrenchments during the 80s. The state was slashing our budget. We had to really retrench on numbers of faculty, number of faculty positions really shrank. But enrollment didn't shrink.
Yes.
And he had to manage all that. And I think he did a really good job, even though some of his moves weren't necessarily popular. But I think they were. It was probably a really brilliant managing of a really bad situation. And he brought us out of it. So that was probably his strength. He wasn't really good at dealing with faculty morale issues. I don't think he quite understood what it was about and what he needed to do. And that frustrated him, but he didn't really know what to do about it. Nancy Bell came in And that was her strength. She built up morale, you know, almost overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually pretty impressive. I remember meeting a couple of our senior colleagues who were, you know, very cynical.
Yes.
In the reception line at one of the holiday receptions. Uh-huh. You know, they confessed that they were now
uh-huh.
back with the program, and that they thought she was really doing a great job. And,
yeah.
So she managed to erase a lot of that cynicism.
Uh-huh.
Then Werner came in, mm-hmm. and he shifted the emphasis back to the academic matter, mm-hmm. and so it was kind of an interesting,
mm-hmm.
you know, progression. Yeah, he had been denied the chancellorship before. It was still a presidency.
Yes.
When Nancy Bell came
uh-huh.
in. Probably one of the stranger mistakes that one of our search committees
uh-huh.
made was they eliminated Werner as a candidate
uh-huh.
right off the bat, which really hurt him.
Uh-huh.
But I thought he deserved to be a legitimate candidate
mm-hmm.
in the provost for quite a while. And
yes,
I think he may have been eliminated partly because some people, as a backlash to Lazarson, you know, but I don't
uh-huh.
think people necessarily perceived that he was his own person because the provost has to be loyal.
That's right.
That's right.
And
I think that may have been mm-hmm. one of the main reasons, but I think on the whole it worked out well because he learned a lot from Nancy Bell about
mm-hmm.
the morale issues and things like that he, you know,
mm-hmm.
really didn't learn under Lazarson.
Yes.
One of his strengths was the lack of ego. You know, he never let
yeah.
ego get in the way of
mm-hmm.
rational decision making. And he was a really good problem solver. I mean, he knew how to sit down and think things through. He was great for, you know, the deans to go in and bounce ideas off
uh-huh.
and get help.
Collegial.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. he, you know, was supportive of the faculty.
Yes.
In the past, there have been perceptions that the central administration really thought the faculty was the enemy.
Yes. Well,
real or not, that was a perception.
Dan Corbett said in his interview that UPBC really became a more democratic institution for planning, somewhat under Nancy Belk, but especially under David Werner, that he really used it.
It was a creation of Lazarson.
Yes.
When I first came, the governance structure was a university senate, and it had
yes.
faculty, staff, and students. It was one
uh-huh.
senate. And then somewhere early in Lazarson's term as president, it was decided to split it into
uh-huh.
three. One of the reasons was some of the students wouldn't come to all the meetings,
uh-huh.
you know, and so you'd have a curriculum council.
Mm-hmm.
You had faculty, staff, and students, but a lot of the students weren't interested in some of
uh-huh.
the mundane, nitty-gritty curriculum matters. They weren't, you know, necessarily the big picture ones, but approving courses and that
mm-hmm.
stuff. They had trouble getting quorums. And,
yes.
And so it was decided, well, you know, on a lot of issues, their major interests are different, so
mm-hmm.
let's have three separate senates. I actually was one of those who helped write the constitutional bylaws
oh,
for the
really?
Faculty Senate. I think with Rosemary Archangel, I can't remember, there were a couple other people. And but Lazarson, one of the consuls had been the budget consul, and he didn't want the budget consul to be part of the faculty senate because he thought that should be broader.
Mm-hmm.
And so he forced in the reorganization a separate body, the UPBC,
okay.
to be created. They would still have faculty, staff, and students on it,
uh-huh.
and administrators. He had all his vice chancellors or vice presidents
uh-huh.
in those days served on it also.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but it seemed to have... It had much more real involvement when Werner took over.
Yes, well,
I served on it under the old system, you know,
because uh-huh.
under the old system, when you were Senate President, you were on it. Actually, that was the new system. That was the new one, but it was.
So you were on the first UPBC.
One of the
that,
yeah,
uh-huh.
that's one of the first.
Uh huh. Yeah, one of the ones in the. You were faculty Senate President 89-90.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It had been created sometime in the middle '80s, I think. But.
Uh-huh. Right. Mm-hmm. It had it. You so you were the second or third, probably.
Something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the tasks I had my year as Senate President was to slow down the calendar conversion. Earl wanted to just do it. And we argued that it really takes more deliberation to figure out the details. And so he agreed to slow down the process by, I guess, by one more year, which really helped a lot. Because it gave departments time to think through how their curriculum would be affected and how to make the changes instead of just mapping it haphazardly. And a byproduct was a lot of departments took the opportunity to really revamp their curriculum quite a bit instead of just moving a course here and, you know, from quarters into semesters. So, and we had to do Gen Ed too. We had to revise Gen Ed. And that one didn't get revised in a major way, but it still, there was some tinkering with it that I think was useful because you had to always think about it again.
Yes. Right, doing that now.
But also when I came, the school structure, well, they would call them divisions. Dwight Morris didn't like schools. Schools and departments were out. So the individual academic units were called faculties, faculty of history, historical studies, everything was studies. Yours still is, but some of them, some, all of them were then. ours was mathematical studies.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were all, and they were originally faculty of, you know, so that they wouldn't think of themselves as little separate units. But that didn't really have any real impact.
No.
And the schools were called divisions. And ours was the Division of Science and Technology, included engineering. Engineering at that point was a separate department, but not, didn't have its own degree program yet. It had some courses. The state didn't want us to have engineering because there were other engineering, so why did we need one? And I guess in the first few years I was here, we applied for a degree program on the grounds that we didn't need any new resources because we already had the faculty in the courses. So we got an engineering
program.
In, that was in about 1974. Somewhere there, yeah, we got our first degree program in engineering. And then 6 years later, so 1980, it had built up to the point of having a separate school. So there was one transition year when they changed the name from science and technology to science and engineering, so it had more visibility. And then it became a separate school of engineering. And we just became School of Sciences. In fact, our dean after Lazarson became provost, the dean was Tom Anderson, who was an engineer.
Tom Anderson.
And he was, that was an external search. He was hired to come in to be Dean of Science and Technology as an engineering faculty member.
Yes, I haven't really interviewed anyone from engineering yet.
Interesting, those are gone.
Yeah, I know.
Norval Wallace would have been.
So I thought I'd interview Nadir Sanai, but he's not, he's going to have a narrow view, I think, of, you know, his own agenda there.
Well, Anderson might be interesting to interview.
Tom Anderson.
Yeah, I mean, he was, like I said, he came to the university as dean.
Yeah.
When engineering became a separate school, he was no longer dean. He was in the faculty, then he became a department chair for a while. He served in the grad council for a number of years. So he has a broader perspective of things. He had some problems when he was Dean of Science and Technology, but he still might be interesting to interview.
Because
most of the other senior people, I think, are gone, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They are. So, anyway.
Well, Harlan would be interesting to interview.
Harlan Bankston.
Yeah. Yeah, he, because he was here from the 70s through when he retired as dean. Yeah, he would be really good. He's a thoughtful guy.
Yeah, okay. I'm putting a star by him. Okay. I know I had to interview someone from over there, but I just haven't been able to get anyway, like a good recommendation for it. So, anyway, How did you talked about the changes in organization, and a lot of them were in the sciences.
Yeah.
Changed the way that sciences were organized. did the math department change?
Yeah. The math department, again, it was called mathematical studies, but it was developing a fledgling computer science option.
Uh-huh.
And then during the later 70s, we, I don't remember exactly when, but we managed to get a separate computer science degree program approved, bachelor
uh-huh.
science. It was still in the math department. And then sometime during the mid-80s, the computer science group split off as a separate department
uh-huh.
with our support. Everybody supported that move. Most of the faculty were originally mathematicians who had converted
uh-huh.
themselves into computer science people. They
uh-huh.
had one or two people who actually had computer science degrees. But there was a big transition among some of those. Some of their hires in computer science stayed a few years and then left.
Mm-hmm.
And so the stability in the program were basically mathematicians who had converted, Merrill Livingston being one of the most significant ones,
uh-huh.
Jimmy Hadward, Greg Stephen. But I guess all three of those who eventually became chairs of that department.
uh-huh.
But Merrill in particular had an outstanding reputation as a pure mathematician.
Uh-huh.
And converted herself
yes.
to
computers.
Computer scientist with a pretty good national reputation, too, international reputation,
mm-hmm.
I guess. She was
okay.
doing consulting for Intel.
Oh, well, that's good. uh-huh. Well, that's interesting.
But, yeah, so they split off, and that's shrunk mm-hmm. the department, of course. There were about
yep.
eight of them, I think, that split off. But the math department, one of the attractions for me was it still taught a broad spectrum of courses.
Mm-hmm.
Pure math, applied math, the gen ed courses. And we had a graduate program in my area, which was operations research.
Uh-huh.
When I was at Washington U, I was in the School of Engineering, and so we had my area, but not some of the other
uh-huh.
math department courses, because they were over in
mm-hmm.
arts and sciences. And I enjoyed teaching calculus and
mm-hmm.
algebra and things that were
yes.
not part of the engineering school.
uh-huh. The College of Arts and Sciences, I've been very, very surprised. I guess reading the presidential papers, I thought the arguments for it were quite compelling. But I've been very surprised in my interviews with people to see that there still is a legacy of
right.
hostility toward it.
Only those who were there before. Right?
Yes,
not the
right.
new people.
No, not new people. No, but from these are.
Yeah, I'm surprised
Larry
too.
McEnany was one.
Oh,
he
well,
wasn't here.
He was
retired before it.
Yeah.
But I really had a good interview with him. He took time. He said that he liked the camaraderie of the school. He liked people in similar disciplines. He liked knowing everybody. He liked really knowing the dean, who the dean was.
That was the biggest
and,
factor that
yeah.
people were worried about,
yeah.
knowing the dean.
Yeah.
And then
Carol Keene was another one who regretted the creation of the College of Arts and Sciences. And Peter
yeah,
Bukowski was another one.
some of that's irrational.
Yeah.
I opposed it, too.
Now, that's interesting. When
Warner... this was Lazarson's idea.
Yeah.
He wanted to do it.
Uh-huh.
He wanted to do it because for the right reason, actually, because he felt the arts and sciences are the central core of the university and should be
uh-huh.
together, and it would unify gen ed and
yes.
and really demonstrate that arts and sciences are the core of the university, and most universities
uh-huh.
start with a core of arts and sciences, and then
mm-hmm.
professional schools are maybe added or they're surrounded.
Uh-huh.
And the way we had it, all the schools were co-equal.
Uh-huh.
You know, the business school was
yes.
just had the same number of faculty and cloud as social sciences. You know, there was no difference.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his philosophy, a philosophical reason. But he turned it over to Warner to do it. You know, and Warner's memo had a number of reasons which I thought were schlock. You know,
I read that.
It would be easier to. For budget reasons, but that was because he didn't, as provost, wouldn't move money from one school to another.
Uh-huh.
But he could have done it, and the coordinating gen ed could have been done more.
Uh-huh.
The main problem there was the IS courses, but scheduling other gen ed, but that could have been done with a small committee
uh-huh.
very easily.
Yes,
and
other
so there
people
were,
have
there,
suggested.
There were, way, there were less drastic ways of fixing
yes.
some of the problems. And so I actually testified before the committee and wrote a lot of 5-6 page memo opposing
uh-huh.
it. attacking each one of his reasons.
Yeah.
And didn't want to, and was assuming that I would return to my faculty, my department, you know, when it became,
yes,
when it was created, and teach again. And actually, it was in the schedule. And in fact, I had desk copies of the books I was working on.
Yeah.
When we hired Sharon. And, you know, she came in January, 6 months before the college started.
Yeah.
And as part of my role as dean, and Dixie's as dean of fine arts, acting dean of fine arts, we were helping her,
yeah,
with the transition. Butler and Pearson really weren't, you know, doing that much.
Yeah.
You know, they were kind of, you know. But Dixie and Sharon and I met a lot to talk about what needed to be done, and just nuts and bolts. Here's some things we need to think about and do. And
yes.
And so we, you know, so we got into the flow of, well, we really need to make this. The decision's already made, so we need to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So then when it came down to it, both of us applied for associate dean positions. We did a national search.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I had to convince Dixie to do it. She originally had agreed, then she said, well, you're applying. I don't need to apply. I said, well, there's two positions. You're applying too. So we each applied for separate ones.
Uh-huh.
And,
It seems like we've done really well by hiring people from the inside.
Most of the time,
yeah. And we've had some great continuity in the university. David Warner and David Ault and Dixie. It's different people who've been here.
Yeah, in the provost office, you know, the biggest mistake we made was our external search, our external hire, 2 years.
Yes.
But then,
I didn't know her, but I've heard a lot about her. Yeah.
Yes, well, we can talk about that sometime if you want. But then, you know, Warner followed by Sharon in the provost office.
Uh-huh.
He's really been out, you know, just the next, because they have a lot of similar qualities, but they
uh-huh.
play off each other well, you know.
Uh-huh.
She also doesn't have an ego. She's a really good problem solver.
Yes.
And they're both
mm-hmm.
perceived as, and in reality, are fair. You know, they really
yes.
are fair. So Sharon was an external hire as dean, but then an internal hire as provost.
Yes. Uh-huh. Right.
And as dean, it turned out to be really brilliant.
Uh-huh.
The college, I think, has been a really big success on the whole, and that's
yes.
mostly to her credit.
Mm-hmm.
Because it could have been a big mess.
Yes.
As you say, there lots of people were hostile.
I've been so surprised.
Lots of people were hostile.
Uh-huh. People say this was the biggest mistake we ever made in the history of the university, because I was asking.
And I think there's a lot of reasons why it actually turned out to be really good. You know, one is she made it work.
Yes.
But it really did unify general ed.
Uh-huh.
The idea of that Larry McEnany talked about being close with colleagues in similar disciplines.
Yes.
Well, the opposite is probably better.
Yes.
You have more interaction among people from different disciplines,
mm-hmm.
and I think for a university, that's good.
Uh-huh.
You know, the fact that the structure that was created for the college,
uh-huh.
Has committees of, you know, one person from each department on a lot of them.
Yes.
And then the subcommittees have four or five people, but they're from all
yeah,
over the place.
Right.
They're not all from. You know, there's no subcommittee that's only social sciences or
yes.
only sciences. They're all from all over the
yes.
place, and I think that's been really good. The budget part has been really good.
Yes.
Back in the old School of Science, the School of Sciences and the School of Fine Arts
uh-huh.
had lots of problems with equipment
mm-hmm.
because their budgets were so tiny.
Yes.
And they couldn't buy major equipment, you know, that they needed.
Uh-huh.
One of the years when I was acting dean of sciences, chemistry needed a $250,000 piece of equipment,
uh-huh.
and our equipment budget was like $30,000
yes.
a year. What you can do with that? That one we solved by working on a deal with the graduate school, where
uh-huh.
they bought it and we kind of paid them back every
yes.
year.
Yes.
But you couldn't keep doing that. That was a one-time
no.
shot. But with the arts and sciences budget, you could move money from one place to another from year to year.
Uh-huh.
So there's 1 year, you know, music needed a $40,000 piano
yes.
or an $80,000 grand piano, you could buy it.
Uh-huh.
And then the next year, that money would go to, you know, biology or someplace
yes.
else.
Yes.
And so we established a committee that had faculty on it,
uh-huh.
you know, that actually went through and helped make those decisions.
Uh-huh.
So actually the collaborative aspects of which, you know, we created the Sharon kind of introduced. Uh-huh. Some of it was in the structure, and some of it she did more of. Because the other one was on faculty positions.
Uh-huh.
In the old school structure, you had very little latitude on hiring. And furthermore, as people retired and you wanted to replace them,
uh-huh.
you know, you save some money because you're hiring a junior mm-hmm. person, but not enough to hire more than one. But if you, when uh-huh. you have the whole college and 12, 15 people retire,
yes.
you can create new positions and put it in a department that's growing. And uh-huh. that's what we did. And we did it, you know, through the chairs. You know, the chairs would meet every year and decide who, where the positions would go.
Yes.
And some, you know, sometimes you'd lose one, but sometimes you'd gain some. Most departments ended up gaining net faculty over the years, I think.
Yes.
Yes. Quite a bit in some cases. And the biggest problem became, where do you put them, right? There's no office space. And in the sciences, there's no lab space. But those are, you know, better uh-huh. problems than not having enough faculty and having
yes.
to hire tons of call staff to teach, you know, courses.
Yeah. It's really nice to hear this global picture. I've studied all this now, and I felt that when I was chair, I didn't know anything. Of course, you recognize that. But I just was like a mole. You know, I just didn't have a global picture of things. And I hope the new faculty are socialized into all these positive aspects.
That was true
aspects.
In a lot of people. Uh-huh. You know, we were in our departments and maybe in
yes.
our school,
uh-huh.
and that was it.
Uh-huh.
And the big picture.
Yeah,
and that's one of the that's another advantage of having the colleges. At least
yes.
for us, we have a larger picture of the university's uh-huh. mission and our role in it.
Uh-huh.
Professional schools are still pretty much where they were.
Yes,
but I think it's really been good for the CIS faculty.
Uh-huh. That the other regarding the money, I'll say one more thing. Someone said in their interview, "Oh, the problem with CAS is everything is hidden now. The money is all hidden," and I think that is I think.
That's always the conspiracy theory.
Yes, the conspiracy theory of the money, that there's always money hidden. And but of course, this is Carol Keene. She always favored publishing the salaries. And
right, that's from the old School of Humanities, published salaries.
Yes, she said, now we're back to the secret salaries, and we're
but
and the money
salary
is hidden.
Money's in the budget in the library.
Yeah,
anybody can go look at it.
Right.
But publishing it doesn't do anything but cause morale problems.
Yes. Yes, I can understand why.
And her department, the philosophy department, still today, is having huge morale problems because of salaries.
Yes, yes.
They still are. I mean, it's been stirred up again.
I know.
But in general.
Uh-huh. I'm just telling you what people have said.
So I think there's been more. Yeah. And by the way, that's another area, though, because when you had this retrenchment
yes.
6-7 years ago, the dean's office was able to protect the departments. That no department
uh-huh.
took a cut in budget.
Uh-huh.
When we slashed the budgets 2 years in a row,
uh-huh.
even though in the other schools that wasn't true because they weren't
uh-huh.
big enough to, you know, to have to deal with that. We
uh-huh.
were able to cut it in the dean's office.
Yes.
And also, you know, with call staff and moving
yes.
around, there's a lot more flexibility. And the summer budget is another area where
uh-huh.
The scale has really been a help. I know a lot of people don't see that. And like I said, I didn't think of it either till I got in there and was actually
the
on the other end of it trying to work. Well, you've got a much larger summer budget.
Yes. Okay.
And so it's easier to address departmental needs.
Mm-hmm.
If you only have four or five or six departments and you've got this
mm-hmm.
little summer budget.
Yes. Can't address
it. You really are tied too much so that
uh-huh.
you know, you can't really address. A lot of times it would come out,
yeah.
you know, you assign a department what they had last
right.
year, but because of the particular people teaching,
mm-hmm.
the salaries will be out of whack.
Uh-huh.
And she might need to throw an extra
$3,000
into one, or they might need an extra course taught for,
mm-hmm.
for their curriculum for this summer over last summer,
uh-huh.
that they teach every other year or whatever. You could actually do things like that.
Yes.
You know? And with more and more retirements, actually, you know, people getting 3-month summer contracts,
mm-hmm.
that would have really been a disaster in some departments
uh-huh.
if we'd been back in the old school. Structure because we wouldn't have been able to help alleviate that. You know, they
yes.
would have had two people teaching their whole program,
yes,
six
summer.
Courses or something, and wouldn't have been fair to the rest of the department.
No, that's
so. I think there were a lot of pluses that I didn't really envision before that
yeah.
turned out to be true. So I ended up
deciding
it was a good idea.
When you're planning for in an uncertain budgetary situation and Dan Corbett talked about this system that he invented of setting, well, he did it with tuition money, though. Did you set aside a fund, a contingency fund, for in case of budget cuts, or did you, was this kind of throughout the university, this kind of budgeting
pattern? Yeah, I think once that there were those years when we knew that this was a possibility, and Werner was provost, he directed that we set it, hold some money aside. But the main part of it came out of the central pot. It came out of the faculty development fund and the equipment pot. Which they could, the faculty development fund, they could hold the second half back.
Yes.
And the equipment, also library acquisitions.
Yeah.
They could hold those until February or March and then release what they had. You know, if the worst came to worst, it wouldn't affect an ongoing program. Because in the departments,
yes,
you're teaching courses.
That's
you can't
right.
cut in the middle of the second semester, even at the beginning of the second
That's
semester.
Right.
Everybody's already signed up for the courses. You
right.
really, and you don't want to do that. That's the last place you want to cut.
Well, it seems like we've had really great financial leadership
university. I think my Anderson and Warner is a sequence.
And then down at the lower level, too. Yes, I mean, I think you were good, and Wendy's really good.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah. Just because it isn't true at other institutions that we have.
We've also been lucky with our business manager, first Jim Maddox and James Schramm. Schramm in particular has been really amazing manager of our money.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess the other area that's kind of been good is the development office. You know, we had started, I guess maybe before the college, right around the same time when they decided to push some of the fundraising down to the schools. And since we were bigger, we were able to hire the development director. The other schools started off sharing one. So business and engineering had one, and nursing, I'm not sure how they grouped it, but they were sharing, which didn't work too well.
No.
And
then Bob Carver came in and took off the school.
but we've been able to have our own full-time development person who's done a pretty good job of raising some money, which we've used for a lot of it for things like student travel. And some other faculty initiatives, special little grants that we've done.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And an endowed chair, I guess they've got now, right? The going.
Yeah, it's the going chair, but I interviewed him. He was really upset that they were going to. He wanted it to be announced after his death, I think. And, so he's not. I don't think he's going to attend that, but maybe he will. But I don't know. He was upset about it.
You wonder why he would want. I can see where he might prefer that. I can't even see that. Why he actually would be upset about it? I can't understand.
I don't understand either. But anyway, I thought he was. Anyway, we talked about changes in organization in the College of Arts. This is really good to hear you talk about the College of Arts and Sciences. In fact, the book is going to be organized around memories.
It would be interesting to hear how Farley and some of the people who really were adamantly opposed feel
now.
Well,
I think Farley feels that it's been a good, overall a good thing.
I think most people probably do. But McEnany and Carol...
Peter,
I'm not sure what his issue is, but the issue of being closer to the dean is the one lost.
From my point of view, why do people want to be closer to the dean? Or not a person who never would go to the dean
chair. Especially the deans we have, I guess they felt they could go up and knock on the door and go in and say, I need to talk.
Yeah.
But you can still do that. It's just... It seems more remote. There's a really interesting psychological thing about being in a different organizational structure or a different building. It distances it much more than it has to.
Yes.
And I remember even before, in the science building, again, when I first came, engineering was part of the science, part of our unit. And so they were on a different floor, big deal. But they were part of our, they were all on different floors. Once they became a separate school, it was like they moved out of the building. And they were still there. The dean's office was still in the School of Sciences. In the science building. And it was like they weren't even there anymore.
Okay.
And And I think that's why some people who are, you know, the dean's office is in Peck and they're somewhere else.
Yes.
They think it's, you know, but and art and design has this problem because the department is split into two different buildings.
Yes.
And they've always resented that and felt that it was bad and they needed to be in one building. And it would be a good nice if they were all in one building, but it's not that far, you know, to walk.
No.
It's not like we're the University of Illinois, you got to get in a car and drive. But people can still, you know, pop into the dean's office and...
Yes, I know. They can.
And so I think communication is really not any... is not pretty much the same. The one difference is, I guess, in the old schools, we used to have every term at least one all-school meeting. But now we just have the... Now that's too... We do have one in CIS, but it's too... It's different. It's more formal because it has to be. It's not really so much of a discussion type meeting.
Yes.
But we've done it through the, but we still have the committees, which still have one person from each department. So, you know, on the whole, I think it's really been much better than what most of us thought. I think, actually, you know, the fact that I think probably most of the faculty who are going to be in those, in the CIS opposed it, or were leery about it.
Well, the
ended
faculty...
Ended up liking it, and it definitely benefited them, whether they knew it or not.
Yes. I think that's true. Someone like John Farley, for example.
Yeah.
And that people then they talk about the way the college was created at the last minute. Wasn't there a faculty senate vote against it or something that had to be kind of ignored as it went forward?
I don't remember. We had a study committee.
Yeah, the study committee was a delay committee.
The Dennis Hotsetter.
Yeah. I've interviewed him.
And. You know, because I remember he's the one I had lunch with him one day and wrote this memo opposing it.
Yeah.
And I just laid out reasons, but they recommended it.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the Senate did. It probably opposed it.
Yeah, I think it did.
But not necessarily because the people in the professional schools didn't could care less.
Yes, right.
You know, they thought it wasn't going to affect them one way or the other, and I think they were wrong. Because, you know, we're now the big gorilla on the block.
Yes.
And it could have, you know, it could have, there's a potential if the college wants to throw its weight around to really.
Yes.
And when, in fact, when I was at Washington U, this happened. I was in the School of Engineering. And we required for our students a year of English and a year of PE, a year of English. And the English department decided it wanted to eliminate, they didn't want to teach all these freshman courses. And so they adopted a requirement that they were going to teach one semester. You know, and we had a lot of trouble with that because we weren't part of that decision. We were a separate school.
Yes.
And they were in arts and sciences, you know. And I think we eventually managed to get them to agree to keep teaching the course for our students. I think they got more liberal about waiving people out of it if they had, you know, a certain SAT score or something. But they... I think there was another requirement with the band PE, or I can't remember what it was, but there was another requirement that the arts and sciences decided to do away with that we couldn't control because you know we weren't part of it. It just seemed like they didn't really care. And so it was nice to have an arrangement here where all the schools were equal and decisions were made by a faculty senate as a whole, not one school. Under CIS, that's still true, but CIS can dominate if it chose to be malicious.
Yes.
Could dominate the faculty senate and the whole and everything else. And it hasn't.
No, it hasn't. But you're right. I think in the history of the university, the business school has really been a center of leadership and initiative, or the lingo that people give me is the entrepreneurial. But, you know, they use it. But it seems like
most of them from the economics department.
Yeah, since CAS, it isn't in the spotlight so much anymore.
I think it's because just some of the people who those people weren't replaced by other people like-minded people. So like the GPA 300.
Yeah.
Those people, you know, along with some of the CAS people, created it. And now the business people are the ones who got rid of it.
Yeah.
Because the new people and the new leadership don't see the value of it. I think it was an unbelievably great course.
Yes.
But it's gone.
Yeah.
And, but a lot of the business school leadership in that course, you know, Pug and Don Elliott. And another one. Well, and even Strickland. He's not a business person. He's a sociologist. He's got a PhD in sociology. So you know, they're not really, they weren't trained in business environment. They were trained in arts and sciences.
Yes, in arts and sciences. So, but it seems like they are.
Another development back in the, I guess, late 80s was the fact it was collective bargaining.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
And collective bargaining, you know, one year that I guess the NEA initiated, the IEA, they were the first to collect signatures and get it themselves on the ballot. And
yes.
So in response, the IFT, which was led by Farley and Dave Hoffman, and the AUP set up their own groups. I was president of AUP the year that they had we had the election.
Yes.
The year before it, Carol might have been president. And then Warren Handel was president the year after. Oh, and Paxson was president. That
yes.
The year that we decided to seek collective bargaining representation. It was partly in response to the IEA, which was very hostile to the administration, was publishing all these.
Yes, these newsletters. I've seen those.
They were full of misinformation and distortions and you know, the old stir up the troops type stuff. But they were just, wasn't really respectable. I don't know. And it's funny that Feeney, Bill Feeney and
was it? I thought the earliest of union organizing was.
Lazarus was already president.
Yeah.
And my
didn't get an election
my view
until
was,
later.
We needed to do this not because of our current our administration, but because of the board. The board was trying to, you know, was throwing its weight around and getting meddling around too much, and they were actually tying his hands too. And I tried to tell him that. I said, you know, this is from my point of view, this is going to help protect our camp, whole campus, not.
Yes.
But he didn't see it that way, of course. And the early on, the IFT and the AUP merged. They merged for the purpose of collective bargaining. We created one proposed bargaining representation out of our joint committee. And so we had this joint committee. And in the election, the first round, nobody got a majority.
But there was a majority for a union.
Yes, there was a majority for a union, but it was spread over the two groups.
Oh,
right. IEA got some, and we got some. I guess they got more votes than we did by about 10 or some real small number. But the total was greater than the no agent one.
Yeah.
So then there was going to be a runoff between no agent and IEA. And IEA refused to bring us into the group as a kind of a combined, unified, and they lost.
Yeah.
Even though I think we technically endorsed them, but they lost anyway because they were seen as too radical, I believe. That was the reason. And then a couple of years later, the year I was assessment director, was the second election. And I think it was only IEA against no agent. I don't think anybody else was involved.
Right.
And IEA contested my right to vote because I was a quote administrator.
Yes.
I was really upset. I said, I'm supposed to be representing the faculty here. I don't have any administrative authority. I don't hire anybody. I don't fire anybody. I don't make any policy decisions. I coordinate the committee of faculty, which makes all the decisions. But they wouldn't let me vote. I thought that was pretty rude. And I
that was.
I feeding a memo about that, which he never answered. But
yeah.
I thought that was uncollegial.
Yes. Yeah, well, the union only lost by about 3 votes, didn't it?
I think on that one, I don't think on that one it was that close.
Wasn't it? No. Oh, okay, maybe I'm thinking of a later one. There was an election later in '88. Another one.
Well, that was the one. It was in 80. It was in 90, I guess. Because,
that's when you were there. Okay, yeah. That's the one then.
I don't think it was.
No, I don't think it was that quite close.
I don't remember.
Uh huh.
But
the funny thing is,
that it never happened again because then again, Teeters. Nancy Bell came in, and the main reason that collective bargaining wins is when the faculty doesn't trust the administration.
Mm-hmm. As at Carbondale.
And at Carbondale, they've always had problems.
Yeah.
The year I came here in 1972,
yeah,
Carbondale laid off 108 tenured faculty and got censured by the AUP, the national AUP. And, you know, I remember my dean over there saying, "You're going over there?" And I said, "Well, first of all, I'm not going into engineering. I'm going to the math department."
Yeah.
And secondly, I'm going to Edwardsville, not Carbondale.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they didn't even know what Edwardsville was.
Yeah.
A few years later, one of the things that we tried to do actually in my department was to develop a joint doctoral program with in computer science with the computer science department at WashU, which is where I come from. We had it all worked out. The IBHE shot us down.
But
both the schools had it worked out.
That's too bad.
My former dean who came over here, and he'd never seen the campus before. He was amazed. Never seen it. And it's a beautiful campus.
Oh, it is beautiful.
And
that's too bad.
Had it all worked out. We actually had our first student in it, who was one of our instructors in our department. Uh-huh. She had a master's degree, and she was going to go on and get a doctorate through that program. And was already in it.
Uh-huh.
We had started.
Now, that was about when?
In the mid-70s.
Mid-70s.
75, 76, somewhere in
there. Yes, that's when the IBHE really took a turn against SIU.
The interesting thing was some of the opposition on this campus was from people who said, we'll be considered, you know, second fiddle to Washington U. They won't treat us as And so, we'll just be second fiddle. Well, we set it up so that our faculty could chair a doctoral committee.
Sure.
And it didn't matter who chaired it.
Yeah.
And we could go over there and teach courses. We had it set up really. And when people saw it, they realized it really was balanced, and, cool. and our faculty did have credibility. And so when you created your history program.
I was thinking, didn't get that deal from Carbondale. They still have to chair the committee.
Right. And if anything.
I know. I know, and we have the big, great faculty, but
yes,
yeah. So that's how it goes. Well, we've been talking about. I want to ask you about the buildings. Do you have any comments about the buildings? Your experience of them when you came here? Did you? Because you're always aware of these. Aesthetic and things, and
well, it was quite different from Washington U, which had small buildings of 2 stories, and with 15-foot, 20-foot ceilings and large windows in the classroom. Buildings with a lot of classrooms had no windows, and
that wasn't Obata's though. That was Delight Morris. The original plans had windows in the classrooms, but it. There was a theory about windows distracting the students. Yeah. Delight Morris was.
How can you daydream if you can't look out a window? But you know, I guess I came here in the first courses I taught were in summer school in '72. And I think it was either the first or second class. I think my very first class, the air conditioner went out. Before class, building in the science building.
No
air conditioning. It's June the 15th or something. So we had to deal with that.
Wilt.
But we also had, by the way, some of the art and design and nursing were in the science building when I first came. And I think geology. There was some geology faculty in there. But one of the things I remember encountering my first summer, I went down to the basement to the vending machines, and there at the vending machine was my 8th grade art teacher. She had joined the art department.
Person. Evelyn, what was her name?
Budemeyer.
Evelyn Budemeyer.
Yeah, I remember her. Huh?
No, Jane Floyd Hendy has mentioned her.
Oh,
as,
really?
Because she was in art education.
Oh.
That was her major here.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Ellen Buttermeyer was my 8th grade art teacher in junior high. And that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Actually, I had Lazarson as a teacher, too, at Washington
uh-huh.
U.
You did?
Yeah, in 1963. In fact, when Kennedy was assassinated, we were supposed to have class at 1 o'clock
uh-huh.
that Friday, and the assassination was at like 12:30.
Yes, I remember that.
You know, I remember going over there, and Lazarson was pacing the halls outside his office,
uh-huh.
and you know, he wasn't going to have class. There was no way he could
uh-huh.
have class. And he was just really upset.
Yeah. Huh.
But the buildings, I guess in some ways they've undergone changes, in other ways they haven't. You know,
uh-huh.
I guess I taught and had classes in the library in the basement here, and the science building, and the Peck building, communications building, and then once they got buildings 2 and 3, I had a couple of courses over there.
Okay.
So I've taught and all around.
Oh.
You know, that I don't know what to say about the buildings. The science, once I became acting dean in sciences, I had to deal with the condition of the science labs,
uh-huh.
which were falling apart.
Uh-huh.
That was 15 years ago, and they're still falling
uh-huh.
apart. And I discovered that somebody had put in the, you know, we had to put in these planning documents for the Senate. I can't remember what they called them, new program requests.
Yes,
new and improved. Somebody put in $3 million to renovate the science building labs for new casework, you know, just
because
the casework was rotting out. But the whole that was just a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
I mean, you needed the run. So we started that back when I was acting dean. We started a project to, we wrote some NSF grants initially to try and get some,
uh-huh.
they had some special program for lab renovation to try and get money to renovate the labs, and we tried to get the state to do that. Now the, what's his name? Larry Sanders, I guess, was president of the system.
Ted Sanders. Yeah.
Ted Sanders.
It was Larry
Pettit.
Was the earlier one.
Another weird one. Yes. Ted Sanders. He was not. He was opposed to new construction.
Uh-huh.
Only
That's
renovation.
Interesting.
And so we had to convince him that you couldn't renovate the building
uh-huh.
without new construction, because you'd have to shut the entire
uh-huh.
lab wing down.
Uh-huh.
And have no labs for 2 or 3 years while you remodel it, because
yeah.
of the heating and air conditioning, was
uh-huh.
the way it was set up. You know, you couldn't do it floor by floor, for example.
Yeah.
You had to do the whole wing. But, and so it took a couple of years. Meanwhile, when Sharon came in as the beginning dean of CAS, so that very first semester when she was the dean, but we hadn't yet created the college, she joined our planning group. And we, you know, we did a whole planning process to develop what we need for the building. We got some small amount of funds to hire an architect to do an initial model of it. And then we, you know, again tried the NSF grant version
uh-huh.
on the grounds that if we got a couple million dollars or ten from them, we would put some leverage on the state to come up with the rest of it.
Uh-huh.
But we never did get external funding for it.
Yep.
And meanwhile, it's slowly risen through the priorities. Every year we brought groups of legislators and other state-level people, IBHE people, up to campus
uh-huh.
to tour the science building.
Uh-huh.
Because if you tour it,
you
see what a disaster it is.
I
mean, it's just unbelievable. And so now it's up there. And if they finally release money to actually hire an architect
uh-huh.
to do the detail
yes,
design.
The planning money, and the $2 to $3 million planning
right, and
money.
Right, and then it'll go out for bid.
And it's on the top list for the
it
state.
It is, so once the architects design it, they can then go out for bid. Now, they have to get approval to go out for bid. So hopefully that won't get slowed up. Engineering got really screwed, because when they went through that, they got the planning money, and they developed
uh-huh.
the detailed architectural plan, and then the state got hung up, and I think it was a partisan bickering over who would get credit for what, and so a lot of the state major capital projects got frozen. And so theirs was sitting there frozen. They had it all ready to go out for bid, and they couldn't do it. It took them, I think, 3 years before they put it out for bid, and then cost more money because, well, costs have gone up, and then they had to make decisions in it also.
Well,
but eventually it really turned out well.
I interviewed Richard Walker. He's in charge of the buildings now.
Oh,
and
okay.
He says, we have to hope for the re-election of Governor Blagojevich if we want the science building. And if he's not elected, it goes back, you know, it'll be the same thing as happened with the engineering building. But he said then maybe in 3 years we'll have a really great building. So that's...
See, I think engineering on the other was one that worked out well, the smart design building.
He was thinking the science building, well, if we had to wait, it would work out. But I don't know.
You know, the enrollments are still putting a tremendous pressure on the building, especially with pharmacy.
I know.
Pharmacy, they never should... Here, all of a sudden, you know, we've been waiting for this building.
Yes.
Because of space needs, and all of a sudden we create a school of pharmacy where all of those students have to take a lot of science labs, and there's no place to put them. I don't know how they're doing it. I think they're running on weekends, and they were running most evenings anyway. You know, but.
I don't know. Maybe the new, maybe they have some labs in the new pharmacy building. I don't know.
But that hasn't been built, has it?
Well, no, but they've converted the old...
University Park?
No, the old engineering, where the engineering were, where textbook rental is.
Oh.
That's been kind of converted into the College of Pharmacy. And they had $11 million. Yeah.
No, electrical engineering labs were in there.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know what's going on. But anyway, it's just kind of a sad situation. Because
The art design building is one that I think that, you know, was... has suffered problems because of they penny pinched on it. The original design, I think they're actually, the original design had an extra floor in it that would have housed the entire faculty. But they cut it out. And then they also, I believe, cut corners on the HVAC, which caused a huge problem because you've got these art studios where they're using chemicals, you know, that.
Yes,
and then
right.
The system sucks them in and circulates them throughout the whole building. It was like, oh my goodness, who thought of this? Science building had a problem like that, sort of, when the they would get sucked out and vented onto the, you know, out on the, onto the roof. But then the fresh air intake was also up on the roof, so it would bring it right back in. And they finally put these big smokestacks up to disperse it
right.
Higher. But they wouldn't do that at first because they were going to, you know, renovate the building and it looked ugly.
Yes.
So for about 3 or 4 years, they wouldn't put the stacks up there. There would be occasions when we'd have to evacuate the building because it was so stinky.
Oh, dear.
From the organic chemistry labs, you know.
That's amazing. That's really interesting. I've never heard anything about that.
We also, and so there were a number of times when we evacuated the building just because of, you know, foul odor going through it. There was one time we had to evacuate because of an explosion. That was a disaster.
Yes. I've also seen in the files, I mean, I didn't really follow it, but I've seen in the files how there was some person, maybe some unbalanced person in chemistry who was creating safety problems. We don't need to talk about that. But
yeah, not on the record.
No.
The Illinois Bureau of Investigation came in and investigated 1 year. There was an actual poisoning incident.
Yes.
The cookies.
Poison cookies.
They had arsenic on them. That was real. The cookies actually did have arsenic on them. That was never solved. But there have been periodic incidences of disruption in the chemistry lab, you know, just vandalism. Refrigerators being unplugged that have things growing, you know, things that need repair.
Yes.
And or other kinds of equipment, that things like that that periodically have occurred.
Yeah.
But this explosion incident, there was a grad student working in a lab.
Oh, yes, I kind of remember reading
and
about
there was
that.
An explosion. He actually lost an eye.
Yes.
But it was hazardous chemicals, and we had to evacuate the building and shut it down for what ended up being, I think, 2 full days while a specialty company came in and cleaned it up. And people couldn't get back in, even if they had left their purses with their car keys in or things. You could not get back in the building. So that happened like in midday. And so...
Was that in 1985?
No, it was, while I was acting dean, so it was like 1992 or 3 or somewhere. Two, maybe.
Okay.
So I met with Warren and we talked, we decided that that we would tell our staff not to come in the next day, but to check with information number to see when the building would reopen. And they were just to, you know, stay home and check in periodically to find out, because we didn't know. And so that night, I go home, and the next morning I find out that Ben Quillian, who was then the VP for administration and therefore in charge of personnel, and Sheila Cox, had decided that our civil service people should report to work. Somebody was seriously injured, and the whole building was, you know, a mess. That whole lab was blown up. And they couldn't go into their offices because they were shut down. And they had to report to work. They were supposed to report to personnel, and then they'd be assigned somewhere else where they could do filing or some stuff, which made no sense because, for one thing, they were upset. For second thing, for one day or two, whatever office they would get assigned to would have to train them. It would take time to show them how to do this filing.
It would probably reduce efficiency.
It wouldn't really help too much. It was just a thing to show them who was boss. They couldn't get the stay. Then the personnel started calling them, telling them, either you report at 8 a.m. to work. They were calling them at like 7 in the morning. Either you report at 8 o'clock or you take a day of vacation. You have to take it as a vacation day. And I really fought bitterly over that, but I didn't get anywhere. But I thought that was just really terrible. And it kind of overrode what Werner and I had talked about. Although he had agreed to it once. Quillian had talked to him about it. I guess he didn't oppose it. And they didn't actually tell me either. Then they wanted me to write a report on the incident, you know, but they wouldn't give me access to the official police report. That's odd.
It is odd.
I don't trust me enough to.
Yes.
Bring me into what's going on, but they want me to write to do my own investigation, talk to the chemistry chair, and etc.
That was an amazing incident. I asked you about turning points. You've mentioned a lot of them along the way, so.
Yeah, I think they're kind of buried in there.
I think they are. Are there any other themes that you would want to emphasize?
We've come along, you know, what was interesting was this, the year I came, I think the enrollment was like 11,000, 10,000, 11,000. Apparently in 1970 it peaked at 12,000 to 13,000. But most of them were part-time. And over the years, we had more and more full-time, even though the total enrollment didn't change much. It was between 10 and 11,000 almost for 30 years until, you know, the last four or five when it started. The residence hall caused it to grow again. And that's had a particularly dramatic effect on freshmen. Because freshmen was always like 1,000 to 1,100, and now it's like 16 to 1,700. It's tremendous growth in freshmen, and therefore sophomores. We always had this inverted enrollment where we had more juniors and seniors than freshmen and sophomores, and nobody really understood that. And now it's probably more equal. The residence halls have made a tremendous difference in the culture among the students. Even the ones who are still commuters, have friends on campus, so they tend to stick around more, and it's more like a college experience for them too. And I know because I went to Washington U, and I was a commuter student. But most of my friends lived in the residence halls, and so I didn't really view myself as a commuter. And I don't know, I just didn't think of it that way, because my whole social life was on campus. And I think that's much more true now than in the 70s, for sure. So I think that, and I guess Nancy, Lazarin started it. And for a long time, we were prohibited from putting residence halls up. You know, Tower Lake. The original Tower Lake was only put up because Rendleman argued. The state argued, you're a commuter school, you don't need anything. And he argued back that, well, we have some some of our students are married and they have families, uh-huh. and grad students come from uh-huh. a larger area. And we need housing for graduate students and married students.
Yeah.
And so that's why Tower Lake was built as apartments. Yeah. They're all 2 and 3 bedroom apartments. There's no residents right. all over there.
right.
And that's great for married students and graduate students, but it's terrible for 18-year-olds.
Yes.
And so it never really worked really well until we finally got permission, not using any state money, to put up our own residence hall.
Yeah.
It's also been pretty amazing that we've been able to creatively finance.
Yes.
adding additional ones by turning over the money that, as we retire uh-huh. bonds from the previous ones. It's pretty impressive.
Yes.
And so now we're going to have a fourth one, I guess, going up.
Yep, Evergreen cool. Hall.
Yeah. I think that's been great.
Yep, I do too. So that's a turning point that you hadn't mentioned before, was the residence halls. Well, any other special memory here?
No, I don't think so. We'll probably think of some later. It's about time to go.
Yeah.
Well, we can.